Yeah, great to be together, and this will be just a brief foray into the Megillah we try to do every year to interrupt the regularly scheduled program. So it's great to see so many of the regular participants and also some others. Wonderful to have Carol with us also, and Joe, and what I wanted to talk about this year, I think, no surprise. Has to do with, Haman as kind of like a paradigmatic figure of anti-Semitism. Because I think that for, many of us, the encounter, the reemergence with, very, very widespread anti-Semitism is a subject of not only great concern, but it also a subject of some reflection and like the study of Haman as a character, and in particular, the way that he's discussed in the Megillah, those aspects of him that drive him towards genocidal aspirations, I think is really an important line of inquiry for the moment. And I think it also, at least in my judgment, is revealing. There's no question that there have been different kinds of genocidal anti-Semites, over history, and it's a whole field of study. But I think that there are certain, features, let's say, of Haman and the way that he's communicated to us that really, do help us, advance in our own understanding. I'm not saying that this is like a, the goal is to understand it and therefore, make peace with it. Of course, it has to be fought as it was in the Megillah, but I think that it is important for us to understand at least certain basic truths that emerge from the Haman narrative. So let me jump right in with that. The title this year, gives a lot of it away, is that I think that the Megillah makes a very compelling and unapologetic argument that Haman is a fundamentally irrational character. That is to say, and I'll lay out the thesis right here at the beginning, that any attempt to sort of, explain in some reasonable framework, in some logical framework, Haman's desire to annihilate all the Jews is itself, like a complete misunderstanding of Haman. And I think the Megillah really tries to make this point that there is no rationalizing, there is no basis for, the genocidal aspirations of an anti-Semite like Haman. There are certain character features that he might have that drive him towards that, but there's no, rational basis, let's say, in the behavior of the Jewish people or in the, character of the Jewish people. And I say this because, we've discussed in the past here in different contexts, Mark Twain's very famous, essay that somehow anti-Semitism is rooted in, the historical persona of Yosef and the way that he treated the Egyptians. And, to try to explain it in rational terms, I think is a very, itself kind of a pernicious thing, and also very futile. So let's take a look. Achar ha-dvarim ha'ele gidal ha-melech ha-chashverosh es-haman ben hamdata ha-gagiv ha-yenaseyu v'yasim et kiseo me'al kol ha-sarim ha-sharito. So the Megillah expresses to us that Haman has this meteoric rise. He hadn't appeared, at least not explicitly, in the Megillah at any point before that. And again, the Megillah describes in very remarkable terminology, right? Gidal v'yenaseyu. The Megillah is saying is that this man, out of nowhere, really had it all. The Chazal dramatized this point. They say that, Haman worked for many decades in, less prestigious industries, that he had served as a barber, for many, many, many years. Again, nothing wrong with that profession, but, not the kind of person that you would necessarily bet on to become the viceroy. And he's exalted and elevated in an almost absurdist way. The king establishes a decree that not only is this guy, all of a sudden, extremely important and extremely powerful, but, that people have to bow down to him. Okay, so Mordechai, of course, you know, famously won't, you know, yield to this. He's not going to genuflect in front of Haman. And, you know, Chazal have their own views on this. Was it somehow affiliated with idolatry, with the Avodah Zarah? You know, what exactly about, Haman, you know, made Mordechai, you know, resist in this way. But whatever it was, and Mordechai is not willing to go along with this. Again, Mordechai is not going out of his way, you know, to provoke Haman. It's just, you know, when the opportunity comes, Mordechai will not, you know, comply, you know, with this practice. Vayomra de Amelech Asher Bishar Amelech L'Mordechai, Madua Ta Over Eis Mitzvah Samelech, Vayikam Rami Lav Yom Vayom Velo Shema Lehem, Vayagidu Lehaman, Leros Hayamdu, Divrei Mordechai, Ki Yid Lehem Asher Hu Yudi. So just a sort of proof of concept that I'm suggesting, you know, we talked about this recently in other contexts as well, that, you know, it's really interesting, you know, like Haman himself wasn't even aware that Mordechai wasn't bowing down to him. So this wasn't the behavior of, you know, some, you know, instigator, some provocateur. You know, it had to be reported to Haman. You know, it wasn't like, you know, again, he was going out of his way. He simply, you know, wasn't willing to go along with this. So Vayar Haman, so Haman now, you know, experiences this. Ki ein Mordechai koreo mishtachavelo, vayimalei Haman chema. So Haman becomes incensed, infuriated, enraged. Vayivez be'enav lishloach yad b'Mordechai levado, and for unexplained, and I would say even inexplicable reasons. So Haman generalizes this phenomenon. Ki yidulo es am Mordechai vayivakesh Haman lahashmid es kol hayudim asher b'chol malchus achashverosh am Mordechai. Right, so 127 provinces. So he's now taken this, you know, insult regarding which he was you know, altogether unaware initially, and now that he's seen it, and you know, he's determined that this is, you know, the only, you know, possible solution here is the final solution. B'chodesh harishon u'chodesh nisan v'shtash ne'im b'sreil ha'melech ha'chashverosh hi pilpur hu ha'goral lifnei Haman miyom liyom u'mechodesh l'chodesh shneim asar hu chodesh adar. So as I'm making the argument that from a logical standpoint, if you were Haman, you know, you would think that you would have a lot, you know, to lose. It seems like an extremely risky proposition to, you know, engage in, you know, an actual genocide. And you're sort of doing the cost-benefit analysis. You're saying, you know, I have this meteoric rise. Everything seems to be, you know, working out in my favor. There's one person that's giving me a hard time, so I could, you know, ignore it. I could do a targeted strike. But instead, you know, Haman irrationally, inexplicably decides to, you know, in his rage, you know, to attempt a genocide of the Jews. In this case, I think that the Pur, which gives its name to the holiday, is a case of the method sort of reflecting the substance. The Pur meaning, you know, to be without any reason or explanation. It's totally arbitrary. It's just, you know, by chance. I mean, I think that that is meant to reflect the very substance of Haman's anti-Semitism and, frankly, any previous or subsequent form of annihilationist anti-Semitism, that there can be no reason for it. There's nothing about what happened that somehow justifies it or even explains or excuses it, certainly. It's only a reflection of the genocidal, you know, party itself. So the Pur, right, the arbitrary lot, I think is a deep comment, you know, on that. Chazal, I think, were deeply, you know, aware of this, and they can capture in a very, you know, dramatic way, you know, two aspects of this irrationality, as I call it. Vayivez beinav lishloach yad b'Mordechai levado. So the Gemara says, Amar Rava b'tchila b'Mordechai levado. So initially, you know, he was incensed at Mordechai. Ulevasov ba'am Mordechai umanu rabban. And then he sort of extrapolated and said, well, Mordechai is, you know, a Talmud Chacham and a rabbi, so let's go after all the rabbis. Ulevasov b'chol ha'yehudim. But again, there wasn't any sense of, you know, rationale, just kind of this extrapolation, this, you know, consuming hatred that permeates his character. We'll talk about that a little bit more subsequently, but basically, you know, it's not like, you know, there's a logical analysis at each of these phases in Haman's thinking. You know, once he moves past Mordechai Levado, so he moves on to, you know, all of the rabbinic personalities, then to all of the Jews. You know, this is a kind of, you know, inexplicable, unexplained, and also inexplicable leap that he's taking, right, that, you know, I think is critical for us, you know, to internalize, that any attempt to try to explain it, you know, the Jews are successful, the Jews are very unsuccessful, you know, whatever it is, there's never really an explanation. Amar Rava, so Rava says, and, you know, based on the conversation that goes on between Haman and Achashverosh, so Laka Diyana Lishna Bishna ke Haman, that Haman was like a world expert in Lishna Bisha and Lashon Hara, which I think has multiple layers of meaning, as we'll see. So Amar Lai Tanach Linu, so Haman makes a suggestion to annihilate the Jews. Amar Lai Mistafina Me Elohai, so Achashverosh expresses a practical hesitation. Achashverosh was not one to express moral reticence. He's basically an amoral person. Not really immoral, but amoral. Didn't really operate in moral categories. Wasn't a lot there. So, you know, Achashverosh says, well, you know, annihilating all these people, though, that could be bad for me. Meaning, you know, what's going to happen to me? After all, you know, Babel, which made, you know, an enemy of the Jews. So look what happened to the Babylonians. Amalei, yashnu mina mitzvos. So they're detached from their mitzvos, so you don't have to worry. So Amalei, isbehu rabbanan, but they have rabbis. Amalei, am echad hein. Apparently, you know, Haman, you know, had reason that they're judged on some collective basis. I guess that was itself kind of like a projection of his own collective judgment. Shema tomar karchan yosef malchus echa mifuzarin heim bein ha'amim. You know, don't worry. It's not like we're going to, you know, destroy an entire one of the 127 provinces, because they're sufficiently scattered. So it's not going to, you know, cause too much of you know, a shmama, desolation of any particular location. Shema tomar is hanoa minayhu, and if you'll say, but they're, you know, productive citizens. Meforad kepredezo sheino osaperos. V'shema tomar ika medinta minayhu tamlomar v'chol medinos malchusecha. It's not going to in any way diminish from your prestige. You know, you rule over 127 medinos. Their annihilation won't even subtract one. V'datehem shanos mikolam. This is part of the Gemara. I think it's particularly fascinating. D'lo achli minan v'lo nazbi minan v'lo minsevi lan. So, right, now you hear the process of rationalization. It says, well, you know, they won't eat our food, and they don't marry our, you know, our women, and they won't marry off their daughters to us. Vestate ha-melech enanom sim, demafki l'kulo shata, b'shabes hayom, pesach hayom, they're always taking off from work, you know, for these holidays. V'la melech en shavela nicham, de'achlo v'shasim evazule l'malka. And they, you know, they denigrate you. Afilu nofel zvuv b'kosel shalachan mehem zorko v'shoseyu. They have no problem drinking, you know, if they get rid of the bug. Im adoni ha-melech nogea b'kosel shalachan mehen chobto b'karka, right, there's yayinesach v'enu shoseyu. Okay, so basically, I think what the Gemara is telling us is that Haman had decided that he wanted to kill the Jews, you know, all of them. He was incensed by this, you know, insult to his honor that was, you know, Mordechai not bowing down to him, and this kind of, you know, deep fury and rage, totally, you know, uncontrollable rage from Haman. So then, you know, in presenting this to Achashverosh, he feels like he has to somehow come up with, you know, different svaros, different reasons, you know, that the Jews deserve this. So, you know, Shabbos Hayom, Pesach Hayom, they're not, you know, good workers. They're, you know, taking off too much time, and maybe they make personal insults at you, and they don't observe our customs. So again, all of these, you know, are ex post facto. He already decided, right, for his own personal reasons, that he needed to engage in this, you know, annihilationist project. And then later on, so, you know, there was, you know, whatever it was that was going to serve as the excuse, you know, and you can fill it in over the years. And typically, again, as has been observed by so many, you know, from the communist standpoint, the Jews were the international financiers. From the capitalist standpoint, the Jews were hardened Bolsheviks. You know, so whatever you need, you know, to sort of fill in, you know, for that, so that's you know, what the Jew can be. It's this amorphous quality, because there really is no explanation. It's only at the level of, you know, rationalization, or you know, in the what they would call today, you know, the media strategy, you know, for Haman, it's a media strategy of one, you just need to convince Ahasuerus, but now, you know, you need to convince a few more people, you know, on social media and the like. But, you know, it's basically the same idea. So whatever, you know, you say, you know, you come up with all different kinds of things that they're doing or that they're not doing, you know, after you've already decided on the annihilationist course. So this, I think, is really a critical contribution of the Megillah to our understanding of annihilationist anti-Semitism, that it's a conclusion, you know, in search of a reason. It's a policy, you know, in search of justification. And that's exactly the process that Haman, you know, goes through. And that, of course, you know, is, you know, completely consistent with what we've observed since then, you know, historically, and, you know, to this, you know, to this very day, you know, the that kind of annihilationist impulse, which then searches for an explanation, searches for a justification, I think is such a, you know, a critical model for us, you know, so as we don't end up wasting our time, you know, in a futile way, in a maddening way, trying to, you know, understand these things in rational terms, because they're fundamentally irrational, like I said, not just unexplained, but inexplicable. So I think this also now leads to a certain pivot I'd like to make in the shiur, just in terms of a little bit of Haman's character. And I want to again make it extremely clear that I'm in no way saying that, you know, everybody with this personality type will then become, you know, an annihilationist anti-Semite. But I do think it is instructive, right? So far in stage one of the shiur, what we've said is the annihilationist impulse says nothing about the Jew and says everything about the, you know, the genocidal, you know, sociopath. But in this case, I think we can take it one step further. And I think Chazal do offer a particular, you know, model of Haman in terms of what, you know, may have caused him, again, nothing that the Jews did, but what caused him internally to have this, you know, extrapolation. You know, Mordechai, you know, doesn't bow down to him. So again, instead of either ignoring it because, you know, things are going really well for him or having some kind of a targeted strike against Mordechai, he just, you know, has this totally uncontrollable rage. So Amar Rab Abba, Mashal d'Achashverosh v'Haman l'mahadavar doma. So typically this source is, and rightly so, you know, is understood with respect to, you know, Ahasuerus being, you know, a willing participant in Haman's annihilationist plan, which I think is absolutely correct. But what I'd like to try to do is look at it, you know, from Haman's standpoint. So, you know, how would you analogize the Gemara saying, how would you assess Haman and Ahasuerus? So the Shnei Bnei Adam, le'echad shayelo tel b'toch sadehu, le'echad shayelo charetz b'soch sadehu. So two individuals, one of whom has this, you know, mound of dirt, you know, which is kind of in the way, and one of them has, you know, this, you know, gaping hole. So Baal Charetz Amar mi tainli tel zeh bedamim. So Haman is analogized here to the Baal Charetz. So he's somebody who has this deep, vacuous hole in his sense of self. Right? He has no stable identity. He's a Baal Charetz. There's just this hole in his, you know, persona and his understanding of himself. So the Baal Charet says, you know, who's going to give me, you know, I'd be willing to pay good money for this mound of dirt to fill in, right? So Baal Atel Amar, so Ahasuerus says, who's got this mound of dirt, so mi yitain li charet zeh bedamim, right? So liyamim nizdavgu zeh hitzol zeh, so Amar lo Baal Charet, so Baal Atel, mechor li telcha, so, you know, I'm willing to pay for it. So Amar lo tolata bechinam vehalavai. So here I think, again, very illuminating. So Ahasuerus actually is presented here in this mashal, take to be very revealing, as the one who had the mound of dirt. He actually was a certain kind of anti-Semite. I mean, we have the only time Ahasuerus appears in Tanakh, outside of Megillas Esther, Sefer Ezra Nechemiah, where it says that he was Kosev Sitnal Yoshev Yerushalayim, that he wanted to stop the construction of the Beis HaMikdash. So Ahasuerus here is likened to somebody who has this mound of dirt that he wants to get rid of. Like, you know, he had something, you know, against the Jewish people. You know, whatever he imagined that to be exactly. So Haman, it doesn't really work that way. He's just this Baal Charetz. He has this, you know, really this gaping hole in his soul. Anything which is done that somehow, you know, let's say, triggers, you know, that the deep emptiness, you know, Ahasuerus, you know, creates this model for him where, you know, he's elevated and people bow down to him, and then Mordechai somehow punctures that, and, you know, he experiences this incredible rage. His whole personality, you know, it's like, you know, this emptiness. The only way that he can manage to fill it, right, is, you know, by engaging in this, you know, genocidal kind of a plan. There's no positive identity to the man. His entire identity is a certain kind of emptiness, which is then filled with these, you know, genocidal aspirations. And it's really very striking. There's a Mishnah in Perkei Avos, you know, name of Reb Elazar HaKapar, Kina ve'ataiva ve'akavod, motzinas ha'adam min ha'olam. And the way that Rabbeinu Yonah basically explains that, both, you know, people who have, you know, jealousies and people who are unable to control, there's a taivos, but kavod, this, you know, pursuit of, you know, honor, motzinas ha'adam min ha'olam, is just so damaging to a person because, you know, they you know, need some kind of validation, you know, of their standing, and they're constantly, you know, chasing it, you know, instead of developing some kind of a healthy sense of who they should be, of what their, you know, aspirations might be. The Gemara in Masachas Chulin, you know, may capture this, I think, in a particularly, you know, important way, saying, you know, Remez lahaman min haTorah minayin, you know, where do we see Haman in the Torah? And it's a sort of acute Gemara on its surface, but I think a very deep one, properly understood, is a reference to, you know, the sin of the Eitz Hadas, right? Hamin ha'Eitz, of course, being letters of Haman, you know, Asher Tzivisei lo sochal mimenu achalta, did you eat of that tree? And again, the analogy being, you know, Adam and Chava, or at that point the Isha, had everything possible that a person could have, you know, in Gan Eden, and yet it wasn't enough. And when they are denied this, you know, one thing, so that, you know, becomes their undoing, because they can't, you know, live, you know, with that, you know, with that sense of you know, what's prohibited. And so Haman has this almost absurdist position where Gidal Hamelech Achashverosh, as Haman ben Hamadas Hagagi vayinasehu vayasem eskiso, everybody's to bow down to him, and there's one thing that he doesn't have, you know, vayimalei Haman chema, and he's just, you know, completely undone. He's just completely unable to, you know, manage, you know, with this affront. So I think for us here, you know, Haman is a particular kind of a character, you know, who, you know, has this deep vacuum, you know, at the core of his soul. I think one of the iterations that we have in today's iteration of the annihilationist impulse, again, fundamentally equally inexplicable, a policy in search of a justification, to be sure. But I think that this Baal Charetz, kind of the whole, the vacuous nature, right, is so, you know, is so critical to our understanding of the current moment, right? Tragically, you know, when it comes to what it is that we're experiencing. So the terror of Hamas, right, there's absolutely no, you know, positive identity that could be associated with that. There's no aspiration, you know, towards anything. It's a culture of total and complete negation, right? Of definition, not vis-a-vis, you know, oneself, but definition vis-a-vis, you know, sort of the negation, destruction, elimination of others. There's no way to fill, you know, that charetz, in an affirmative sense, you know, quite literally by building things up, but only by destroying, right? You know, what would these people do with themselves if, God forbid, you know, Israel disappeared tomorrow? You know, there would be nothing, you know, that they could possibly stand for. So, you know, for marketing reasons, there's, you know, latching on to different ideas, you know, which they had many, many opportunities to, you know, actualize, like a state, you know, and that was tried for decades, you know, as if that was what they really wanted. And again, you know, what we see is just a total culture of negation, of not any affirmative, positive sense of self or what one should be aspiring to, but a sense of self which is totally dependent on a negation. Haman, you know, in his relationship with Mordechai, and then the extrapolation, you know, from Mordechai. So we see that today, you know, in terms, and again, all of these sometimes well-intentioned attempts by, you know, others in the world, the Western world, to try to, you know, figure this all out as if it could be explained by, if we just gave them this, if we just gave them that, you know, are doomed to failure on this basis, because it fails to really comprehend the, you know, culture of negation that one is dealing with. It was never about attaining, you know, a specific goal other than, you know, the elimination of, you know, this enemy. This was recognized, you know, by some, actually grateful to somebody who used to be involved in Israeli government and sort of moved into academia, pointing this out. But Dr. Einat Wolf, who's, you know, a really interesting person in terms of her own political journey. She was sort of on the Israeli left in the 90s when, during the Oslo Accords, and, you know, since you know, really, to her credit, you know, really in an open-minded way, rethought many aspects of her, you know, approach. So one of the things that she talks about is, you know, coming to terms with this exact idea and noting that it was observed by one of the, you know, British ministers in the mandatory period, who, prior to Britain surrendering the mandate back to the United Nations, observed that the conflict was fundamentally irreconcilable. Said, for the Jews, you know, the great, you know, purpose, their overarching purpose, is to achieve a state, to achieve sovereignty in their ancient homeland. Okay? The fellow's name was Bevins, who observed this. How big the state is, you know, the Jews obviously would like more rather than less, but that was not the primary issue, and that's basically remained consistent, is that, you know, Jews have demonstrated great flexibility, you know, on that point, since before the state was created. The important thing was, you know, Leo Sam Chavshi Be'artzeinu. He said, on the other hand, the Arabs, you know, later, you know, dubbed the Palestinians, but the Arabs, right, seek the destruction of that state. They do not seek the creation of a sovereign entity. Right? If they, you know, had wanted that, they would have accepted the Peel Commission, they would have accepted the partition plan, they would have accepted, you know, Camp David, they would have accepted Olmert in 2006. They never wanted that. It was always, so Bevins diagnosed this very, very early on, that there was never a sincere, you know, they said that's what makes it irreconcilable. These are two fundamentally irreconcilable goals. It's not that the Jews want a state and they want a state and we have a problem of figuring out how to share a relatively small piece of land, which would definitely be complicated, but not fundamentally irreconcilable. Problem was, Bevin said, that the Jews want a sovereign entity and they don't. They don't want the Jews to have that. That's considered to be an intolerable, you know, offense, an intolerable, you know, presence of a Jewish sovereign entity in the middle of the, you know, Muslim or Arab world, as you want to put it. So Bevin said, you can't reconcile these two things. You know, it's reminiscent of the story of, you know, Shlomo HaMelech with the two, you know, women. You know, one of them wants a child and the other one doesn't want her to have the child. It's you know, these are not reconcilable aspirations. And I think, you know, to be positive about this, as moving to the conclusion with my presentation, So I think that there is benefit in that. So number one, again, for tonight, that, you know, genocidal anti-Semitism from the days of Haman until today is a conclusion in search of a justification. It's not something that was, you know, Haman later on came to the idea they take too much time off from work. You know, we don't like their kashrus laws. We don't, whatever it is, we don't like their shechita, their bris mila. You know, it's always ex post fact. That's number one. Number two is the culture of negation. You know, this vacuous personality that has no identity other than to sort of latch on to destruction of the Jews as their cause. So that, I think, is true very much today. I think you see that with people, in every way, you know, who can't manage to generate any positive identity and, you know, then latch on to the idea of destruction of the Jews as their Baal Charetz kind of a phenomenon. And thirdly, to conclude, right, so this idea of the culture of negation, I think that the current moment, as upsetting as it is and painful as it is, so one of the things that I think is helpful for us is that it's clarifying. So, you know, for a long time, they said, oh, you know, if Israel would only withdraw to these boundaries, right, then it would be okay. Or if Israel would, you know, recognize a capital here, or the right of return over here. But, you know, the October 7th pogrom and the incredibly broad support that it has, you know, in the West Bank, there's no free speech in Gaza, it's not exactly so easy to know, but the incredibly broad support that it enjoys, you know, from, you know, many, many corners of the world, you know, and, you know, here in the West as well, particularly, you know, in universities and the like, is so interesting and revealing in that way, right? Because it had literally nothing to do, you know, with, you know, like a territorial dispute. And the people who were attacked in the most brutal way imaginable, you know, were certainly, you know, the vast, vast majority of them, you know, people who were as supportive, maybe the last bastion of the Israeli left that remained. Members of these kibbutzim very famously would ferry, you know, people for medical treatment. There's this remarkable encounter which has been documented by one of the released hostages where she meets, you know, Yichi Simar Yimach Shemo 3 days after and said, why did you do this to us, right? You know, we were the ones who helped you. And you realize that it was never about, you know, again, like a territorial dispute, but and I think if there's one thing that we can agree about with Hamas is that they've been very, very clear about this from the beginning, that when they say from the river to the sea, they absolutely mean it, that there is no concept of Jewish sovereignty that's, you know, can be reconciled, what it is that they envision. It's a fundamentally genocidal, you know, movement. And that's what it always said in their charter. That's what, you know, it always said. I saw such an interesting interview, clearly a well-meaning anchor from CBS who was interviewing a Hamas commander in the West Bank. You know, she couldn't get in, you know, to interview in Gaza. It wasn't going to the tunnels. But, she was having a lot of trouble internalizing this idea. You know, nothing in her experience. And she may very well be an intelligent person, but she hasn't really encountered an eliminationist ideology. So she's really trying very hard to understand what this person, this commander, is telling her when he says, you know, we aspire to totally... She said, when is this going to end? How does this end? He says, well, when we destroy all the Jews. And she said, but like, what about the women and the children? He said, yes, like I just said, destroy all the Jews. You see, like he's struggling to, you know, maybe he thinks she's not so intelligent. You know, and she said, but these are innocent people, you know, the civilians. And, you know, and he says to her, you know, we have to, you know, understand that our resistance will by nature be violent. You know, this is the very nature of whatever words they used for it, you know, Ivy League universities, decolonization, or, you know, whatever terminology they come up with it. But, Right, he was kind of astounded at her inability to grasp the most basic idea that he was expressing, that his, you know, sense of purpose and direction is totally mediated, not through any internal aspiration, but vis-a-vis, you know, the elimination of the Jewish people. And that's the idea of Lahashmid La'arug La'abed es kol ha'yehudim minar v'adzakein tafen Hashem biyom echad. So it doesn't mean that the, you know, people in the West, you know, have been able to come to terms with that yet. They're, you know, that's an idea that they haven't encountered very deeply, and that lack of personal experience, I think, makes it very difficult for them to believe that this isn't economic or territorial or something that would make sense in their lives. And you know, they never fail to try to impose, you know, structures that make sense to them instead of just listening to what the people are actually saying. But for us, I think it has been very helpful and very revealing in that way. You know, this latest, you know, point of conflagration in Teaneck, where this, march on one of the shuls in Teaneck because there's a sale of illegal land. So it struck me as extremely ironic. You know, it's like, all of a sudden we're back to that, that, you know, they've been saying for 6 months, you know, without any, you know, apology, without any sense of shame about it, that it's all stolen, that every inch of it is stolen, which, like I said, is helpful, you know, to have at least an honest conversation about it from the river to the sea. And now they sort of, you're back to the whole, you know, Yehuda and Shomron thing. You're back to the whole, you know, that's really the issue here. Really, that explains October 7th. That explains the need, you know, for the sexual violence and, you know, burning alive and, you know, babies. Really, this is about illegal land sales. Like, so again, you know, these are tactics. It's very, very important to, I think, stay like clear-headed about, you know, what it is, you know, that is going on here. When you have, again, an ideology that is eliminationist by its very nature, that isn't predicated on achieving anything for oneself, but, you know, self-definition only through the destruction of the other. So an attempt to placate it with something that was never asked for. I mean, nobody in Hamas ever asked for, you know, part of the land of Israel. Nobody in Hamas ever asked for, you know, a certain standard of living. That's never what they were interested in. They only have wanted one thing, as Bevins observed from the very beginning, the destruction of a Jewish sovereign entity with however many Jews need to be killed to achieve those ends. And so, you know, for us, you know, and again, as Jews, especially, I think Jews, you know, who have absorbed, I'm not saying we, but especially for Jews who have absorbed a lot of the Western models, that people only want a certain standard of living, people only want, you know, dignity for themselves or whatever it is. So this was a very hard learned lesson. It took many decades to sort of recognize it. But October 7th can be clarifying for us in that way. And, you know, if people don't have any kind of affirmative aspirations, there's no way to really, you know, provide them with something that would be that would be meaningful, you know, in terms of, you know, reaching, you know, a peaceful solution, which the Jewish people always yearn for. So in that respect, I just wanted to conclude by noting that the Megillah for us, I think, can be uniquely meaningful and comforting this year. This is not the first generation in which the Jewish people encounter an eliminationist, totally irrational ideology. And Lahudim Haisa Urava Simcha Visason Vikar. The Jews were able to, with far fewer resources than we have, thank God, today, through divine grace, again, there was Divrei Hatzamos Vizakasam, there was spiritual rejuvenation. And that's a critical part of the story for us today as well. But the Jews were able to overcome this, and God willing, we have no doubt that we will be able to overcome it also. What, you know, is so new for us in our lived experience is not new for the Jewish people at all. Bechol dor vador, omdem aleinu l'chaloseinu. I freely admit, you know, that as a child reciting that during the Seder, I can vividly remember thinking to myself, like, you know, that this is some kind of a historical observation, you know, because I didn't have any exposure to it. But when you're exposed to it, as new and unsettling as it feels, you know, being part of Jewish history is ultimately very, very reassuring. The Navi describes us as an Am Saridei Charev. The Jewish people have survived the sword, and that wasn't only Haman, and it continued in every possible iteration, you know, to this very day. The Jewish people, you know, have overcome it all. So v'nafochu, you know, asher yishlatu ha-Yehudim hema besonehem. When the Jewish people, you know, God willing, will continue to be very, very strong. The Jewish people will stand for the values that we've always stood for. You know, a positive vision for the world, never seek, you know, violent confrontation. We will, of course, tenaciously defend ourselves, you know, haba lehorgecha, hashkem vihargo, but we'll never allow that to corrupt, you know, our sense of aspiration. The biggest difference between, you know, the Jews, you know, and the Hamans of the world is that we've always had a positive vision. We've always had something that we aspire to, l'takin olam b'malchus shakai, yishuvu shel olam tzelem elokim. We've always had a great vision for the world. And even when circumstances have demanded that we focus a great deal of our energy and resources on survival, on defending ourselves, we know that ultimately that's but the means. The ends remains, you know, the idea of bringing a certain positive vision to the world, as Mordechai and Esther put it, divrei shalom ve'emes, right? A vision of peace and truth, you know, for the entire world. And we continue to model that, you know, even, you know, in these moments. And in the end, as has always been the case, the affirmative vision of divrei shalom ve'emes will triumph over the baal charetz, the vacuous personality, with no identity other than one which is created around an eliminationist, you know, genocidal impulse to try to define oneself vis-a-vis, you know, destroying in a totally inexplicable way somebody else, so or Jewish people. There can be no doubt that ultimately we'll be victorious. It doesn't mean that the path there is free of great pain and great challenge, but we have to experience that within the context of a deep and profound emuna, not only in the ultimate victory, but in the history of the Jewish people, which teaches us, if nothing else, which teaches us the lesson of Jewish resilience, Jewish survival. And so, again, to me, you know, katonti, as painful as the reemergence of anti-Semitism has been, to feel the strength of Jewish history, the wind at our sails, you know, carrying us forward, the incredible resilience of our parents and grandparents, you know, to be able to survive. And again, things were just so much bleaker than they are now, right? You know, like the and their capacity to continue forward. That to me is a source of, you know, unending inspiration and great optimism. And so, you know, we should all experience this Purim, not only, you know, in the context of Lahashmid, Laharog, Ula'abed, but, you know, even more with the knowledge of, you know, La Yehudim Haisa Ura V'Simcha V'Sason V'Ikar, that the Jews will experience, you know, great light, great joy, and vikar, great dignity, and, you know, and God willing, we should experience that all very, very, very soon. The total victory over terror, a safe return of our hostages, and the reestablishment of Keren Yisrael, of the honor of the Jewish people, which was so badly damaged on October 7th and has been, God willing, restored and will continue to be restored through the great sacrifice of our soldiers and the great resilience of the Jewish people. So with that, I wish everybody a Purim Sameach. And like I said, next week we'll do, you know, we have to